this podcast, we ask Dr. Richard Newton the questions you have always wanted to know about equine herpes virus disease. Hi, Richard, how are things with you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, lockdown is interesting for everybody, but lots of exciting news about vaccines coming out, so which is good.
Absolutely. So, EHV, what types of EHV are there and what diseases can they cause?
EHV, equine herpes virus, is quite a broad family of viruses. There's probably about nine that are known, but we're probably mainly concerned with only two or three of those. Right. And even of those, there is one that's a particular challenge for us. So the three that we're probably concerned about are EHV1, EHV4, and EHV3. EHV3 is a really just a venereal disease of horses, and some may view it of limited importance. EHV4 is probably next on the list. That's mainly a respiratory virus of horses, but occasionally can cause abortion. And then the one that we're all concerned about and presents the biggest challenge in terms of control, and the fact that it's endemic in our horse populations right around the world, is EHV1. And the reason we're concerned about that is because not only does it cause respiratory disease, mainly in young horses, but they can get that at any time during their life, but mainly because of its impact that it will have on horse breeding, because of its cause of abortion, and those can be quite large outbreaks, and also the fact that it's a neurological agent. It will cause neurological disease, and unlike in some parts of the world where they may have a range of different viruses that cause neurological disease in horses, we're fairly limited, and EHV1 is the main virus that we're concerned about.
Right.
But this is a virus that can knock horses off its legs. They are required then to be euthanized, and therefore it can have quite a major impact on horse populations.
So I'm guessing prevention is quite a key thing here. What can you tell us in terms of prevention and the steps that would need to be taken?
Yeah, prevention of any disease has got to be better than control. Mm. The big problem with EHV, and particularly EHV1, is that it has this ability to form latency. So if we think of cold sores in humans, they're herpes viruses as well. Which means that the viruses don't actually disappear from the horse, and they have the ability to re-emerge at times of particularly of stress, and therefore very often we are controlling incidents, outbreaks, rather than managing to prevent them. So anything we can do that prevents that, the onward spread of infection, has got to be useful. And we all think that we need to rely on vaccines, but there's far more to disease control and disease prevention than just relying on vaccines, and that's particularly true for equine herpes virus. So the parallels with COVID are very stark, actually, in that where we have groups of animals that may be moving around for competition or breeding or leisure activities, horses are part of our lives. We're sociable people. And so therefore they do tend to move and gather, and the opportunity then for the spread of viruses is there, and herpes virus is no different to any other because they're spread through the respiratory tract, for example. Therefore, we have to think about the controls that are put in place when we are moving horses. Are we taking sensible precautions to limit that transmission, that contact? Are we taking necessary steps when we're introducing new animals into populations? We may have purchased an animal, we may want to move a horse from one place to another for breeding, for example. And are we taking appropriate steps to limit transmission? Are we using quarantine, for example? Are we using appropriate biosecurity around our horses? Viruses can transmit indirectly, and humans and handlers can be responsible for that. So again, are we looking at appropriate protective equipment and that sort of thing? Are we limiting the opportunity for both direct and indirect transmission? And keeping horses in small groups generally is a good idea if we can do it. So there are a lot of things that we can do, and then obviously we can top that up in terms of vaccination as well.
Specifically on the role of vaccination, why should horses be vaccinated? Are there many owners who don't see that there is a need for it?
I think there is. They may not have encountered the very severe forms of disease, and they may just see it as a bit of a minor inconvenience which crops up every now and again. I'm not convinced that all vets think that EHV is important as well, and therefore the messaging can get dumbed down a little bit there. But I think, you know, if you've been around horses long enough and you are aware of what's going on, then I think you do become aware that EHV1 can have significant impact on populations, and also the ability to use those animals in the way that we do. And certainly the thoroughbred breeding industry, for example, takes EHV1 very, very seriously, because it did encounter, not that many decades ago, significant outbreaks of disease that caused, obviously, loss of foals, loss of pregnancies, and loss of some mares as well. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Owners understanding the importance of these infections and the importance to take all these steps to try and prevent it is really key. And the thing with, I guess, you know, we know about flu and the need to vaccinate there, but with herpes, there's now quite interesting evidence accruing from the likes of doing some modelling, that if you can vaccinate a large proportion of the population, then you're going to confer that bit more protection, because you're going to stop this virus taking off and spreading around.
Sure. And if there are some owners who don't get the message or the importance of it, how should vets best persuade them, do you think?
That's a really difficult one. And I think it's a matter of really pushing the whole health and welfare and prevention message. And I think the times that we're at now, where, you know, we're currently in second lockdown, we've all seen the devastating effects of COVID. And I think probably piggybacking a bit on the back of that. Horses don't thankfully get COVID, but they do get these other things. And you know, there's been a large cry out for vaccines for COVID, and we're now starting to see those thankfully coming through and showing good evidence that they're going to work. And therefore, I think, you know, we're that bit further on with diseases like herpes virus or EHV1 and 4 particularly, because we do have those vaccines. And, you know, whilst nothing is 100%, where they are adopted and they are used and used to a high level, then those benefits will come. And it's really part of a package of what you can do to help in terms of keeping your whole horse population as healthy as possible. And it's one thing that you can do, is to vaccinate them regularly and take these other precautions and do the best that you can.
Is there any point vaccinating one or two horses on a yard if a whole yard is not vaccinated? Is it still important to do that?
It's not ideal. Mm. I mean, obviously, you're going to hopefully make a difference to those few individuals. But we know that, you know, we know from outbreaks of disease repeatedly over time that we've been involved in investigating, is that when you do get disease going around, you not only have the sick horses that are producing virus and shedding that along, you also have these subclinically infected, the silent shedders, if you like, of virus. They're also there. And anything you can do to reduce the possibility of those animals being present will limit the impact and limit the transmission. So it's really all about trying to up that proportion of that particular population that's vaccinated. And it's like with everything, some of the data that I referred to before is based in a PhD project, but that clearly shows that as the proportion of your population that is vaccinated, you reduce the ability of this virus to spread, and you actually protect the most number of animals. So, you know, it's not very sensible to just do a few. That's where the whole yard has to come together and come up with a policy, and everybody adopts the same policy.
Okay. Why should we vaccinate when most horses have already been exposed to EHV and it doesn't prevent carrier status?
Okay. With EHV1, the concept is latency as opposed to carrier. So they are technically, I guess, the same thing. But the fact with latency is that these animals are not always infectious. They carry the virus sort of silently within themselves, and something then triggers this virus to be reactivated, and they can spontaneously become infectious and then go on to demonstrate clinical signs. But EHV, as like other herpes viruses, it's got its life sussed in as much as the horse unfortunately does not entirely clear it, unlike other infections such as flu. If you're infected with influenza, the animal will generally clear that virus entirely, and that in doing so will confer a degree of protection against reinfection. With herpes, it doesn't do that. It's already in there, probably from early in a horse's life, and the proportion of animals that are so latently infected is probably very, very high.
Right.
The proportion that then act as a source or a reservoir for future infection really isn't known. But it, you know, every horse probably at some point has the potential to do that. So what we're asking our vaccines to do is to improve on what nature itself is doing, and therefore, you know, we're not going to eradicate this infection. And so one of the ways that we do that is to maintain this sort of blanket of protection if we can, and limit the impact when this virus reemerges, which we know full well that it will.
Yeah.
So we are kind of fighting fires, if you like, but we're just trying to make sure that they don't become major fires.
Of course. The benefit of vaccinating when the vaccine does not prevent neurological strain, what can you tell us about this?
This again is a real challenge for any vaccine to confer that level of protection. Neurological EHV is a complicated disease that involves probably different strains of virus. It involves particular animals going down with disease, probably related to the nature of their immune response against the infection. As I mentioned before, we know that not all animals in an outbreak of neurological disease will even show any signs, but they will become positive for the virus. They will shed it. And the approach, I think, has to be, like I've said, it's trying to just make sure that burning forest fire is always kept at a low level. And you do that by maintaining all these preventive measures as much as possible, including vaccination. But what we don't recommend when we're dealing with a neurological EHV outbreak is that you then go in and start vaccinating in the face of that, because what we think can happen there is that you could make things worse rather than better at that stage. So it's one of these things, it's much better to think about disease prevention while everything looks okay, animals are healthy, you've not got a problem, and you're doing it in a strategic, elective way. And then when you've got the outbreak of disease, you've then got to bring that under control and then look again at your prevention policies, what went right, what went wrong, were we vaccinating at the right time, etc., and how were we dealing with potential incursions of disease and that sort of thing.
Just briefly on that then, once you have got an outbreak, how do you bring it under control?
It's fairly classical disease control, really, and the first thing you've got to do is stop the movement of the infection, and often with that, this will be generally limited to a premises or, you know, a few linked premises. But the main thing that you first of all do is to stop the movement of animals on or off the premises. By doing that, you are stopping the potential for those silently infected but infectious horses moving the virus off to new premises. Some very large outbreaks in the United States were linked to gatherings of horses and then dissemination away, and that can be pretty disastrous. So that's really the first thing you would do. The next thing you would do is obviously look at what's going on in terms of management practices on the premises. Are they doing everything they can to limit any sort of ongoing transmission between horses there? We would generally, if as we have in the past been involved, we would then recommend that some diagnostic testing is done. So in the same way that we're talking about doing diagnostic testing for COVID to understand, you know, what the extent of the infection is, who's infectious and that sort of thing, then that can be very, very useful. And that can be done through a combination of taking the likes of swabs and blood samples and really just getting a handle on where are we at in terms of this outbreak. And then very often you are, to some extent, reliant on time and the virus then burning itself out, and then you demonstrating that that's happened and that the horses are no longer infectious and you can resume normal activities in a safe way. And what's a little bit perverse is that very often at the end of an outbreak, you've probably got some of the safest animals anywhere because they've been tested. You've demonstrated they've not got virus. There will have probably been subclinically infected animals that could have spread the infection, but you know about those. And you're left hopefully with a nice safe population that you can move animals in and out of much more safely.
Sure.
That can take time depending on the size and the extent of the problem, but generally speaking, where you get good compliance, and that might involve multiple vets, multiple owners, but if they all work together, then they can bring it under control reasonably quickly.
Back on to the vaccination. Does this prevent the shedding of disease?
Shedding of virus? It reduces it. It reduces it markedly. The current vaccine that's on the market in the UK, there is only one at the moment. That's the early data that would have got that product license clearly showed that the amount of virus in those vaccinated animals when they were challenged with virus was much less. And whilst it doesn't completely eliminate it, by reducing it so markedly, you do reduce the opportunity to transmit on and to keep that outbreak ongoing. And that was the basis of this other work, which showed that, you know, by increasing the extent to which you vaccinated, then you reduce the chance of transmission. So it's not a complete elimination, but it's a useful reduction.
And does EHV vaccination make horses more susceptible to neurological strain?
I think the short answer is no. I think, as I mentioned before, neurological EHV is a complex disease. A lot of factors contribute to when or where it occurs. I'm not entirely sure that we understand all those factors. But also, as I mentioned before, what we don't recommend is that when you know you've got an outbreak that involves horses with neurological signs, that you then go topping those animals up with vaccination at that point. Because there is some theoretical risk and some data from America, which perhaps is where this figure has come from, where animals that had been more recently vaccinated and were encountering the virus did seem to be at increased risk. But I go back to it. If it's a well-planned program of vaccination and prevention, then that is fine. It's just be very wary when you know you've got a neurological form that you think about what you do at that point.
And does the vaccine produce any CMI response?
CMI, cell-mediated immunity. The problem with herpes is because of this nature of being latent and actually becoming incorporated within the horse's genome, and the fact that we know, along, as I said, with other herpes viruses, that it doesn't get eliminated, it probably can affect the animal's immune response to different things. So the short answer is that we know that infection will stimulate what we call the cell-mediated immunity, so a different type of immunity than just antibodies. But it's quite hard for killed vaccines, which is what we've got available at the moment, to definitely do that. And workers have shown that natural infection will give a different response to vaccination. So this is an area where I think new vaccines have to explore. Can we get new vaccines that will do much more of this cell-mediated immunity? Will it stimulate the type of responses that we know are needed to prevent as best we can?
Yeah. And you've alluded to quite a lot of research already. Is this an area where there has been a lot of innovation and research, and are we likely to see more products coming along down the pipeline, do you think?
Yeah, the short answer is there's been periods through, you know, fairly recent history of wanting to take this forward. It's proved very difficult. As I've said, the herpes virus is quite a challenge in terms of finding vaccines that will essentially improve on nature. But in the last couple of years, the horse racing and breeding industry have taken a real interest in this, because it was recognised a few years ago that we still may get large outbreaks of abortion, even in well-vaccinated and managed horses. And it was seen that a weak link for this was the vaccine. So work has been going on that front. And what they've been doing is re-exploring the idea that by modifying the virus itself, making it attenuated and not produce disease, can we take the good parts of that, such as stimulating CMI, and turn that into a more effective vaccine. It's a difficult and challenging job. And obviously, at each stage, you've got to be checking out, are you doing the right thing? Is it safe, etc.? And I think what's interesting, again, going back to COVID, is some of these new technologies that are clearly coming through there may offer for broader veterinary medicine, may offer some very interesting opportunities for looking at these viral diseases again and what's available. So I think there are chances that we can see good improvements. But as we were aware, everything for COVID was very much fast-tracked and a huge amount of investment. That's not always the case and is not always available for any veterinary vaccines, let alone those for the horse. So the reality is these are probably quite a good few number of years down the track, but there is work hopefully going to be started again fairly soon.
Good to hear. And in terms of surveillance, it sounds a bit of an obvious question, but I'm guessing this is an area where surveillance can play a really important part.
Yeah, I'm a big advocate for surveillance and have been quite a number of years. And surveillance really is, you've got to know what's going on. If you put your hands over your eyes and you stop looking or you're not seeing what's going on, then things can get out of hand pretty quickly. I mean, looking at the forest fire analogy again, if you turn your back on it, it can come back and bite you quite hard. So that's knowing what's going on. And then when you see a problem, if you can then jump on it, get good cooperation, stop that outbreak getting any worse and spreading elsewhere, then that's really important. So, yeah, and that's why vets in practice are really, really important to that. You know, they're the guys that are on the front line. They're called in to see the problems, sometimes later than we would ideally like, but they're nonetheless on the front line. And by working with them and understanding what's going on and helping them respond, then hopefully we can all do a good job in keeping on top of the problem that is EHV1 particularly.
Sure, and it's an ongoing theme in quite a lot of the podcasts we do, but it's so key that people do work together on something like this, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very much so. And I can't undersell the importance of that cooperation.
Yeah.
I was involved in quite a well-publicised outbreak of neurological EHV earlier this year, and that was a multi-owner, multi-vet premises. And I was very impressed with how they all worked together, the vets worked together. They managed to convey the messages in a coherent and consistent way to their owners. Their owners took on board what was being said and complied. And that, you know, there was expense and there was hassle and there was lockdown. And when that's going on for several weeks, it can get quite hard. Mm. But that example to me was a really good example of how to do it, how to work together. And we've got to remember that in that are the vaccine manufacturers as well, and they take an interest in these things, and we want to work with them as well. So, you know, it's a shout out to everybody that's potentially involved all along the way. And if we can work together, then I think we can bring about the best results that we can.
Great to hear. No, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today, Richard. That's amazing. Lots of information covered and really valuable information at that.
Thank you, Paul.